Today we'll be discussing whether it's possible to separate the art from the artist, and we'll be discussing vitiligo. This is Doctor versus Comedian. I'm Dr. Asif Doja, and this is the Doctor of Laughs.
Not a real doctor.
Ali Hassan. Every episode, I pick a topic for Ali from comedy and entertainment, and I question him about it. Then Ali picks a topic from medicine and health and grills me on that topic. Today, Ali and I will discuss the question, can you separate the art from the artist? And then we'll be discussing vitiligo. Now, how are these two linked? Well, I think we all kind of know that there is a very controversial artist who... who reportedly suffered from vitiligo. So we'll talk about that in our second section. But Ali, before we get started...
Before we get started, you should not be ignoring my Michael Jackson.
Sorry about that. It was quite good. I did want to read a review from one of our listeners. We always ask for 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify. And we did get one recently that I did want to mention.
Okay.
This is from... Mama Pajama, okay? I think that's this person's real
name. MP, we call her.
Yes. This is one of the few non-true crime podcasts that I follow. I love the banter. I feel the urge to jump into the conversation as I listen. Wait, that won't work, she has in brackets. She probably says that all the time with us. A variety of topics made very approachable. This week, I want to say see Godzilla Minus One when we did the best movies of 2023. So this was like a couple months ago. Mm. She was responding to one of our episodes. And I did hear Godzilla Minus One is amazing. I definitely have to see that movie. I've heard many people say it's the best movie of 2023. So I definitely want to see it. I've also had lots of people tell me the same thing, that they want to jump in with our conversations because they feel it's two friends, you know, having conversations.
Is that what it is? Or are they want to jump in because they're like, your arguments are incomplete, you fools?
that's so probably much more like it. Yeah. And I was going to say, Ali, you know, he is an actor and he's a pretty good actor if he makes you think that we're actually friends.
It hurts. Listen, there's going to be some serious jumping in desires today. Mama Pajama better get ready because this is such a loaded topic. This actually could be a two-parter. I think we'll have to sort of aim for some type of brevity, but man, how can you separate the art from the artist? Most people actually can't. But what do you do about it is the question.
Well, let's get into it.
Let's get into it.
So as Ali mentioned, we're going to talk about this. We've kind of danced around this subject for many episodes on this podcast, whether you can separate the art from the artist. And I think we just felt it's about time to actually tackle this head on. So it is, as Ali mentioned, a very, you know, somewhat complicated topic to talk about. And it is a very personal thing. In terms of who you can separate this from, it's variable. So we're going to talk about lots of examples. And we have a lot of good references, some really good opinion articles that you can take a look at. These are from The Atlantic, The New Yorker, The New York Times, Vox. And so we're going to list those on our website so you can kind of get a bit more of a deep dive into this topic. Because as we said, it is kind of complicated. So where do you want to start, Ali?
I want to start by referencing this article in The Atlantic from last year. It is quite long, and also many people don't subscribe to The Atlantic. I do because I teach stand-up comedy, and there's just, by the 10th amazing article in The Atlantic about stand-up comedy, I was like, okay, I clearly have to subscribe to this thing. Also, I should build a university for this. That is a separate issue about my taxes, but I thought this was a very, very interesting article. Again, quite thorough, worth looking into. And this author, Judith Shulevitz, Judith also references another article that Asif and I sort of did a deep, you know, really comb through. Both of them very, very thorough. And I also, you know, sometimes the title... We live in a world, Asif, where the title goads you into something and you go, that's not what the article is about, you scammers. But this was an interesting title that made me want to read more. And I felt it was true to the entire theme. That the title of the article is, It's Okay to Like Good Art by Bad People, Subtitle, Art Transcends the Artist. Now, that is a discussion-worthy piece. Does it, in fact, transcend the artist? I mean, who comes to mind for you? So the first person she references here is Oscar Wilde. Now, I have to admit, here's the crazy thing about this list of horrific people. I didn't even know that half the people on the list were on this list. I didn't even know about these crimes.
Canceled. Yeah, so Oscar Wilde, she talks about how obviously now we regard him as this campy, ironic, queer figure. So witty, right? Everybody looks at Oscar Wilde quotes. But back in his time, 1890s. Of course, yeah, he was homosexual and he was charged with crimes relating to his homosexuality. So then we would think, oh, you know, he was canceled back then or treated poorly back then to his contemporaries. He was thought to be a monster, but now we reevaluate.
But hold on, but you're leaving out the details. Hearing just those details, us, if you think like, oh, society was so regressive in 1890, they were against him simply because he was a homosexual. You need the full story here.
Right,
having
exactly.
Sex with minors, right? This is
well. That's the other thing. So that's what. So now, if you do a bit more of a deep dive, he actually, would have sex with teenage boys. So now we're saying, now we're going back and saying, actually, no, he was a monster. You guys were right back in the 1800s.
Sorry.
So it just shows you how complicated and how these things can change over time. And don't get me wrong, I'm not against certain historical figures in North America. So in Canada, we have some of our prime ministers who, you know, actively harmed, literally, the First Nations and Indigenous population in Canada. And in America, we have presidents who were slave owners. Like, clearly, it's documented. And if people want to say, well, we're not going to have statues of them, we're not going to be on our printed money, we're not going to name places after them, universities, buildings and such, I think that's fine. You know, you had a good run, Sir John A. Macdonald. You had a good run, Ryerson. And, you know, you guys, you know, in the end, we should probably not name things after you. And you had a couple hundred years, and that's good. Now we realize what you were, and that's okay. I don't think just because they've always been part of our history, you don't have to still include them on monuments.
Yeah, monuments, right? But by no means should we be rewriting history. This is another, look, that's another thing, like, you can't take people out of history books because you can only learn from history. You can only, well, actually, history also repeats itself and some people never learn from history. But that is a separate discussion that we can't enter in today. But yes, I think as far as monuments go and anything that's of a anything that has the nature of like paying tribute to somebody that was clearly.
Yeah, we're not honoring these people, but you cannot delete them from history because history is what happened, right?
I agree, Asif.
Yes. And so if you look at it as a big picture, I guess, it's very interesting. There's an article that we're linked to, and there's actually a book by this woman named Claire Dederer, and she's interviewed in a lot of the articles we're linked to, who has a book that came out last year, I believe, called Monsters, A Fan Dilemma, that's based on a viral essay from 2017 in the Paris Review. And she basically says that she wishes that there was like an online calculator that you could use to balance the heinousness of a crime versus the greatness of the art and spit out a verdict of whether you should or should not consume the artist. But of course, she understands that that's not possible. And the real question is, as Ollie was saying, is it possible to love the art and hate the artist?
And actually, this woman, Claire Dederer, I don't know if she's French anyway, with apologies to the exact pronunciation, she doesn't have any answers, which really illustrates what this subject is like, because you can say, you know, it reminds me of this idea of, eating ethically, right? Or buying clothing ethically. I mean, it's all of a sudden you are inundated with, what's that bag made of? Well, you know, you ate this, you know that was made by people who are not being paid a fair wage. Oh, you bought these clothes. Yeah, I bought them at a thrift store. Doesn't matter. They were made in Bangladesh by people who are being abused. I mean, it gets so big. And at the end of the day, you can only do what you can do. And I feel like there is some element of that here. So she has this great line. You know, she says, this is the conversation in her head. She pits herself as the critic who doesn't want to miss out on the, quote, freedom and beauty and grandeur and strangeness of great art, against Claire, the woman, who would like to be a demonstrably good feminist. And so she asks these questions. How do we weigh an artist's accomplishment against his personal wickedness? Generally his, so it is his. Do we believe genius gets a special dispensation, a behavioral hall pass? And these are like the questions we're kind of exploring. And if somebody has an answer, well, good for you. But that answer can be unraveled so quickly, as you say, well, you let give this guy a pass. What about this guy? Do you know what he did?
And right.
It's insane.
Exactly. And it's interesting. There's some quotes where, you know, just like we don't decide whether we will love something, right? There's a quote from one of these articles, you know, a work of art that speaks to you is a work of art that speaks to you. It's not a rational decision what we love. It's not possible to have loved a text or a movie or a performance and then retrospectively to unlove it. But similarly, and this is what Claire Dederer says, the audience doesn't decide if a work is affected by the actions of the artist. She says, it just happens. She calls them now stains, a stain on someone's legacy. The way a carpet is stained when a glass of wine is dropped, it just happens. And so this is balance that you're talking about. And I think it's important, Ali, maybe to talk about different types of art, because I think they are different when you talk about this art versus artist.
I'm down with it. I'll allow it.
There is a really good Vox article. Writers who've written on this subject will say that there is a bit of a difference between a novel and a work of art, let's say a painting, and the artist, because it's easier to separate them from some of these other forms of art, because you create a painting, you create a novel, and then you release it out into the world. The interpretation of that is then based on the reader or the person viewing the art, and they're bringing their own personal experience to it. So it's a lot more of a personal kind of interaction, an individual for every person. As well, it's easier to separate because we know that there are works of art, so paintings, books that are anonymous or done by people with pseudonyms. And so when you're just looking at something like that, you don't necessarily have to associate it with the artist, right? You can. There is this ability to separate.
A great example of that is Satanic Verses, where Salman Rushdie wrote his character had these quote-unquote blasphemous thoughts, right? So he was held responsible for his character, so he was the writer. But I think many people are like, oh, this is just people's thoughts, and we have weird thoughts all the time. Most people will be like, oh God, why did I just think that? That's insane. And they squish that thought. You know, usually it's murdering somebody in cold blood on the road after they cut you off. But still, why does your mind go to such violence and this kind of stuff? So novelists, I think it's very interesting because you often give them a pass, or many people do. Certainly everybody calling for the fatwa on Salman Rushdie did not give him a pass.
And it's true. And it is tough. And sometimes we don't know about them. Like some of these articles talk about how Virginia Woolf and Patricia Highsmith are clear anti-Semites. Like it's well documented. And we kind of unfortunately maybe give those people a pass because they're authors and not more prominently associated with their works. I don't know. But I do think there is a difference. And, you know, the same goes for painters as well. So then I think it's different when we're talking about, say, actors and directors. And then maybe even more with musicians and stand-ups, because actors and directors, you could say you're separating them just because someone has either committed a crime or behaved inappropriately. They're still acting in a movie with many other people, right? And so are you going to like not go see a movie because you're protesting this one person?
Yeah, I think
Johnny Depp
comes up in that Vox article, exactly.
Yeah, he's an interesting character because the Vox article is actually from 2018. So Johnny Depp is featured prominently because now you have to go back in time. This is when Johnny Depp, the Amber Heard allegations were out. There was evidence of a physical abuse with Amber Heard. And so, you know, Johnny Depp was essentially dropped from many movies. He was dropped from the Harry Potter franchise, with the Fantastic Beasts franchise, for example. But of course, now, if we look at that, Johnny Depp is now a somewhat exonerated man, whether you agree with that or not, based on the trial that occurred with himself and Amber Heard. So now he's getting roles again and people are liking it. So it's interesting how these things switch over time. But you're right, for a while, he was dropped from movies. People would not go see movies that he was in. Is that really fair to everybody else involved in the movie, the writers, the other actors, the director, all the people who worked on a movie, the crew who worked so hard, and then, oh, now nobody wants to see it because of the actions of our director or an actor in it? I don't know. Well, I do know that there are some specific examples which are probably worth getting into. And they are both directors that are specifically referenced by Claire Dederer. And you'll realize as we talk more about this, this is a very personal topic. And that's where Claire Dederer goes in her essay and in her book, is that you really have to look at it personally. And she's a film critic, so it's even harder, right? How do you separate Roman Polanski? And she's like, basically, so Roman Polanski, he is basically accused and pled guilty to having sex with a 13-year-old girl. This is not controversial. This happened. Like, there's no
question. He lives in France. He's never been able to return to the U.S. He would be imprisoned upon his landing.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, you could read more about it. He was kind of arrested in Zurich when he went to Switzerland, I think, for a film festival, and they were going to extradite him, and then some things came up, and the Swiss decided to not extradite him, so he just went back to France. And she says with Polanski that she still, even though she's read every, basically, article about this, you know, sexual assault case, she still likes his movies. And then she was comparing it to Woody Allen, who I think we all know Woody Allen. He ended up marrying his essentially stepdaughter, Mia Farrow's adopted daughter. And, you know, she's like, she rewatched Annie Hall and she's like, Annie Hall is great. I still like this movie, you know, despite everything. And then she rewatched Manhattan and she said, I can't watch this movie. He has a relationship with a 17-year-old in the movie played by Meryl Hemingway. I cannot do this. So she's just kind of giving examples of how, you know, you could have a different reaction even in similar circumstances, right?
Yeah. I mean, this is where it gets sort of this rich, complicated territory. You know, a novelist can separate themselves from their characters. An actor, as you said, can be playing something completely different. Polanski's movies, you know, according to one of these two authors, they said Chinatown is still one of the greatest movies of all time, Polanski's
Yeah,
Chinatown.
Most people say that, yeah.
And you know, the movies, I don't know all of Polanski's work, but I think it's like he's creating something very different from his own personal life. Whereas in Woody Allen's case, it's like somebody watches Manhattan and goes, oh, I should have seen The Signs. Why is this older man so interested in this woman who's playing a 17-year-old? You had a choice to make them not, but you directed and acted in it, right? It's similar to Bill Cosby. When you see interviews with Bill Cosby and you hear his excitement about something about drugging women, you're like, oh, that at the time, you're like, that's kind of weird. And now you're like, oh my God, these people are telling on themselves. It gets more complicated in my mind, as you say. He committed this crime, by all accounts, it is a crime, but then married this woman. And then you think about, like, you know, the Chris Browns of the world, despicable person for 100 different reasons. But after he was accused, but I think he was, charges were dropped by Rihanna after he was, after it was clear that he was, that he beat Rihanna. And it's like, you know, in the Chris Brown case, it's like charges drop. So he's paying off a lot of people. I don't think he could have paid off Rihanna.
Yeah, I don't
but this is somebody who forgave him. And now where does that leave us? We're like, this was a big thing I went through. You know, my daughter was like, can we play that song that Chris Brown sang? I'm like, we're not going to play any Chris Brown music in the house.
Yeah, and I think it's different. I mean, maybe it's because I don't like Chris Brown that much as an artist. And then when he did this, I'm like, you're disgusting. And I remember there was an episode of The Office, people probably remember this, where I think they get married in Niagara Falls. It's like a wedding in Niagara Falls. And there's a viral meme where people dance down the aisle to a Chris Brown song. You guys can tell me what it is. I don't remember what it is. And they reenacted that in The Office. And I was like, this is disgusting. Why are you giving this guy any credibility when there's photos? But as you said, Rihanna forgave him. You know, Roman Polanski's accuser forgave him several times. She did reach a settlement with him as well.
Her quote was, it really wasn't a big deal. She was raped as a 13-year-old, and her quote is, it really wasn't that big a deal.
Yeah, and she said, most recently in 2023, she stated, it was never a big problem. I was fine. I'm still fine. And she actually thinks that, like, if he comes back to the States, everything should be dropped. So what do you do with that? Like, he still did that. It is a very tough situation. I agree.
This is the toughest thing. You know, I've never been, like, as far as pop culture goes, I don't remember a moment where I was like, Rihanna, I'm on your side. We're on your side. Our family's on your side. My kids don't even know why they're on your side. They're on your side. And then, you know, these images of her face, black and blue, still in my mind. And she says, I forgive him. And I don't know if I've been in more disbelief with my family. I was just like, same thing. What do we do? What do we do with this?
And, you know, speaking of, you know, we can talk about musicians in general. We should probably group musicians and stand-up comedians together, because it's a lot more difficult to separate them. Like, you can say Johnny Depp is playing a role, I can kind of separate that. Or Polanski directed this film, Woody Allen directed this film, I can kind of separate myself from this. And you notice, of course, since all this controversy, Woody Allen doesn't star in any of his films anymore. That's quite clear. But then you think about, well, when you go to see an artist, like a musician perform, you're going to see them perform. When you see a stand-up, it's them. Like, there's nobody else. So those ones, I think it becomes a lot more difficult to separate them, because there really is no dividing line there, right? And then sometimes you have someone like R. Kelly, who's, you know, found guilty of all these crimes, again, having sexual intercourse and sexual assault with young women and girls. And you listen to his music, which is all sexual in nature, lyrics that play with the idea of consent. It's like, what am I listening to here? As you said, like, are you telling on yourself? Like, this is not, I don't want to have any involvement with this, basically. At least that's how I feel. So I don't know, in terms of comedians, Ali, like, I mean, you mentioned Cosby, but I think that's a pretty straightforward thing. It's too hard to, even if you appreciate some of his albums as being some of the best comedy albums of all time, I personally can't go back and listen to them. The Cosby Show was predicated on him being America's dad. Remember, that's what they called him, and like TV God and everything. Like, but you're not. You're a disgusting human being. Like, you just can't. That I can't separate. Harvey Weinstein can go screw off. Like, I don't have any respect for that guy. I mean, you know. And I don't know. What about other comedians?
Yeah, other comedians, you know, it is this, like, God, it's like this minefield. And I live in this minefield, so to speak, when I teach. Every semester that I teach, my personal belief is that I don't need to mention Bill Cosby. I can mention Dick Gregory, incredible comedian and activist and groundbreaking pioneer in so many ways. I can mention a dozen other comedians from that era and just kind of gloss over Bill Cosby. Or if I mention him, it's impossible for me to not add the footnote that he's a despicable monster of a human being. Louis C.K., again, the friends he had, female friends he had, many of them would laugh at him. Like, Louis, what are you doing? You're so gross. You're a creep, right? Sarah Silverman, other friends are like, oh my God, dude, you're being a creep. Like, it was like, just Louis got a problem. Be careful around him, right? This is comedians. We are, in general, damaged people. We have an understanding of other damaged people. But when you use your position of power and you know what you're doing, you know, this Gian Gomeshi's name comes to mind, obviously, when we talk about this, you are now a despicable person. So, you know, it's quite unfortunate. Gian Gomeshi, a great broadcaster. Louis C.K., a phenomenal comedian. I don't want to talk about those guys. I don't want to talk about their work. I don't want to, you know, learn from what they've done. There's other comedians.
For Gian Gomeshi, just so people know, he is a CBC broadcaster, just like Ali.
Hey, we don't have to mention us in the same, come on.
Sorry. I really like the way he interviewed, these long form interviews, really good. But then he essentially has been accused of assaulting women and engaging in non-consensual acts. And, you know, and rightfully so, he's kind of been canceled. And I think
but found not guilty in a court of law, is another thing worth mentioning, which again adds to the masala that is this mixture here, you know.
But I'll tell you two things about Louis C.K. and Jean Gomeshi. In my, again, just my opinion, you can disagree with me if you want. What they did, there's the level of the art, and I think these two people were performing very, you know, in a very high level in their respective careers. But it's the amount of contrition afterwards that is very important to me. And in my opinion, these two people showed zero contrition.
Very well said.
Zero.
Very well said.
And I cannot stand people like that, because people do make mistakes and people do commit crimes. And if you have shown a true ability to reflect on what happened and you feel remorse and you've demonstrated that, that might be one thing. And then maybe that's when we should think about the victims in these cases. And if they are forgiving, maybe we should be forgiving too. I don't really know, but I do know that people like Louis C.K. and Jean Gomeshi have not, in my opinion, showed any contrition. So it's easy for me to write them off. And I'm like, until you actually show that you're a changed person, I'm not interested in hearing from you or your art.
It's pretty easy. It's pretty easy. I used to talk about this with respect to the mayor of Toronto, not accused of any sexual impropriety, by the way, but he did have a problem, a drug problem. And all he had to do was say out loud, "I have a problem and I'm getting help." And all, you know what happens? All the people who are critiquing him are now the real monsters, because everyone can go, hey, he said he has a problem. He's getting, right? So it's just really that simple. But there was an article a few years ago about why can white men not apologize? What's up with white men and their inability to apologize? It referenced Louis C.K., I believe, but it certainly referenced, what's his name? House of Cards. See, I'm blocking these people out of my memory.
Oh, Kevin Spacey.
Kevin Spacey and Mario Batali are hilarious. If it wasn't so heinous, hilarious examples of apologies gone wrong. Like, really, just embarrassing beyond belief. But they live at a level where they don't even understand how embarrassing it is. Mario Batali was a chef on the Food Network, you may not know, one of the faces of the Food Network, accused of sexual harassment, impropriety with a number of staff over the years, writes an official apology. "I am working to change myself. I am working to, I apologize to everybody who was affected by my actions. I have a lot to work, you know, my family, this and that. And given the time of the season, I would be remiss not to include a recipe for my, I don't know what, raisin bread or cinnamon raisin something."
No, dude, cinnamon rolls.
Cinnamon rolls.
Pizza cinnamon rolls.
Pizza cinnamon rolls. First of all, pizza cinnamon rolls is funny on its own. Are you an absolute buffoon that you would add something as comical as pizza cinnamon rolls, something so generically tacky and ridiculous, to an apology that should mean something to you and to the people? Oh my God, awful. One of the worst apologies I've ever seen in my life.
The best thing about that, and it's strange that I'm saying this, is a blog post by this woman called The Everywhereist. Her name is Geraldine De Reuter, and she is a hilarious blogger, and her tweets are hilarious. She does a lot of food blogging. She said, "I made the pizza cinnamon rolls from Mario Batali's sexual misconduct apology letter." It is a hilarious article about her making these. Oh my God, she is so funny.
The two funniest things I've read is that article and the article about Guy Fieri's restaurant, the person who went to Guy Fieri. Those are the two funniest things in the food world that exist right now. You'd be hard-pressed to
check. So I'm going to link to this because it is just amazing. It is so funny. Oh my gosh. Anyway, so Ali, it also gets into something else, which I guess we should probably talk about, which is, let's just use the example, which is Aziz Ansari. You know, he was accused, there was this article published about his sexual misconduct, and then some people were kind of quick to cancel him. Of course, his show Master of None, it came back for another season, but he wasn't in it. He's done only one stand-up special since then. But then if you read the article, it was basically just a bad date with a lot of,
with a guy who has no game. I think that's what it is.
That's basically it. And it's very clear. The author is like, no, he never sexually assaulted me. If I said no, you know, nothing happened. It's very clear about that. So I'm like, well, you're just kind of complaining about, a bad date. Again, my opinion. But Aziz was kind of painted with this brush. And again, just my opinion, I'm not sure there was a lot there to apologize for. I think he should apologize for making this person feel uncomfortable, which he certainly did.
And he did apologize for that as well. But obviously that wasn't enough. Yeah, that's a mockery in my mind of real cases of sexual assault. I'm with you on that. I was embarrassed for all parties involved, and that shouldn't have existed. And I felt bad for Aziz being lumped into that. I don't think he was like canceled per se, but I do think that, you know, his career certainly did take a hit for some time there. But it is interesting to watch these quote unquote cancellations and how many of them don't stick. First of all, the main issue is the celebrity worship that we have, right? And it runs so deep with some people that even with, I don't know what the last count was, even with over 50 women coming forward about Bill Cosby and saying they want nothing in return, they want nothing. They're not suing for damages. There's nothing financially. They have nothing to gain. They only have to lose by revisiting these moments in their life and dealing with this again. Even still, people are like, they're just jealous of Cosby and you're trying to keep one of the greats, you know. Nobody's trying to. He's already lived his. I mean, it doesn't make, you know, so the celebrity worship is a huge issue. But the other thing is really like, Shane, you know who Shane Gillis is? Does his name mean something to you?
Just remind me. I think we've talked about him before on the podcast.
He's got a special on Netflix right now. A lot of people are talking about. People would not know him from before that. I know him before that because he was part of this crew of people who auditioned for Saturday Night Live, got hired and then unhired, also known as fired, but he never worked a day as far as I can remember because something was found on a podcast he was doing about him mocking Asian people, doing Asian stereotypes, doing Asian accents. It was like tasteless, certainly, for a white guy to be doing that. He seemed like, whatever. He seemed like he was cut from the same cloth as hundreds of comedians just like him who just, you know, punching down is their sweet spot, basically. He now has a great special on Netflix. At the end of the day, it's like, can this person make me money? The people who want money made for them will find a way. You know, you kind of take a little break. Okay, you're going to sit out in the corner for a while and then you're back. And I think, you know, we'll see that with so many different people. And I think, you know, that industry operates at a different level. They don't have the same. They don't go through what I went through with Rihanna and Chris Brown. They don't go through what I went through with Louis C.K. They're just looking at ways, okay, how do we bring this person back? When do we bring this person back, right? It's just like this revolving door. And, you know, we talked about Hasan Minhaj on this. I think we both agree that was a bit of a hit piece in The New Yorker.
No, I disagree with you. I think you're reinterpreting that a bit. First of all, he lost The Daily Show. That is very clear. It's Rory Wood Jr. has said that it was Hasan Minhaj's.
Yeah,
and then
but now he's doing fine. He's
but
adding extra dates to his tour. More people want to see him than ever.
Yeah, I don't know if that was a hit piece. I think in the end, yeah, is it the same as what we're talking about with the other people? No, but I think the fact that he makes up stories. No,
that's a whole other thing. But dude, which comedian doesn't make up things? That New Yorker piece. I mean, I really feel, the reason I say hit piece, this is just a theory, but I really feel like he was accused of having a toxic workplace and nothing came of that. And so this particular journalist was like, I'm going to take him down. I think there was some extra anger. It came at him really, really hard. It wasn't like, tell us about this. What do you think? It was really like, he says, like, we were not told that it was going to read this way. So it's, for me, it's like, you know, you should know what an article's tone is going to be like when you're being interviewed.
I mean, maybe. I think I disagree with you on this. And of course, I can't remember if we talked about it in our Hasan Minhaj episode, but he did end up putting out a video, like a 20-minute video refuting the article, which is so pathetic, right? As I said, that's like someone trying to like get back together with his girlfriend who broke up with him, just pleading and begging. It's absolutely pathetic. But the bottom line is, the real bottom line is, I cannot watch his comedy anymore, because it's not that his comedic parts are made up. It's the parts where he's trying to be earnest and, you know, make a point about Islam and whatever. I'm like, you're just making up these stories. Like, this is not, you're not giving yourself a genuine. So I'm not into it.
That's the parallel, that you cannot separate the art from the artist.
Right, exactly. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Ellen DeGeneres, Toxic Workplace. We've talked about Chappelle just recently.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's interesting that these... some cancellations stick. We still haven't heard from Mario Batali or Kevin Spacey. I think we will. I think eventually we will hear from them again. But others just can't stick.
This is the balance, right, Ali? It's how much, you know, could we live without hearing from Mario Batali again? It's true. I was in Las Vegas a couple of weeks ago. My friend's like, oh, you know, Mario Batali had a really good place here. We should try and go. And he, first of all, I'm like, I'm not going to his restaurant. Second of all, he Googled it. It's like, oh, it doesn't exist anymore. I'm like, yeah, no kidding. He's toxic. And Kevin Spacey, was he that good of an actor that we can put this all aside? And
he was excellent, but there are more. There are more actors that can easily step in and replace
him. And it's a balance, right? Like Dave Chappelle, he just appeared on stage at the end of Saturday Night Live a couple of weeks ago. Just appeared on stage, wasn't on the show. And you could tell, like, Bowen Yang and some other people were taking a step back and were clearly not happy with him just appearing. So I don't know. We'll see where that goes. Why don't we end this section, Ali, by talking about Michael Jackson? And I don't know your thoughts. I'll give you mine. Michael Jackson's a tough one, and he's one where I think I can separate the art from the artist. I can appreciate his songs. Like, at first, I was like, when his songs came on the radio, or my kids liked them, I tried to turn them off and whatever. But I think intellectually I have, and again, people could disagree with me. This is why this, in the end, and this is what Claire Dederer is trying to say, this is a personal thing, and you know, and it just speaks to how you feel about what the person did and how you feel about their art and how you reconcile those things in your head. And so for me, for Michael Jackson, I can appreciate the songs, but anything that kind of honors him, as we talked about before, I don't have time for that. So there's a Cirque du Soleil show of all the Michael Jackson songs. I'm like, no interest in that, right? Because now you're honoring him more, and I don't think
now,
that that's
how much of this, you not separating from him from the art, how much of this has to do with the trial of Michael Jackson was, you know, in absentia of Michael Jackson,
right?
You know what I mean? Like, R. Kelly was there. Bill Cosby has been there. We are watching.
I think that's a huge
trial.
I think that's a huge thing. If he was like definitely found guilty, I think that would make a difference. But you're right. That's not the way it happened, right?
Now we have to believe these two boys. And I don't know. I think a lot of people are like, the story's airtight, but who knows? I think they add a little, you know.
Yeah. And so I don't know. And maybe stuff will come out later and I'll change my mind. But that's you know, I think that's what happens over time. As we talked about before with some of these examples of Johnny Depp and Oliver Wilde, people's perceptions change over time depending on what's going on and what evidence comes out. I just want to finish off with one thing, Ali, which I found was very interesting. And it's a bit, this is Claire Dederer in her article talks about this. She talks about Hemingway's girlfriend, who was the writer Martha Gellhorn. She didn't think the artist needed to be a monster. She thought the monster needed to make himself into an artist. So a man must be a very great genius to make up for being such a loathsome human being. So if you're a really awful person, you are driven to greatness to compensate for all the awful stuff you're going to do to the world. Very interesting perspective on things. And listen, Martha Gellhorn would know. She was Hemingway's girlfriend, right? So anyway, I just thought I'd leave you on that thought.
Okay, buddy, let us talk about vitiligo. We have been talking about this subject for a while to talk about it a little bit more formally. I have questions. Vitiligo is something I've known about since probably my 20s. And prior to that, there were some uncles who were sort of around that definitely had some kind of skin condition. We didn't know what it was called. We didn't know the term for it. If you heard the word vitiligo as a young person, that's not a term that would stick. That's a word that it doesn't compare to any other word. You know, so even if I had heard the term, it didn't mean anything to me. A friend of mine, one of my friends from my youth, he started getting just on his chin, this patch, this discoloration. And it went away. It took about a decade, but it went away. But since then, I've learned that vitiligo is considered a chronic condition for many people. It doesn't go away. So my questions were around, do we know what causes this? I already know what you're going to say about that. I'm pretty sure. I can guess. It's the same thing you say about every single condition. How does it happen? When does it happen? How much of the world is affected by it? And is there anything people who have vitiligo can do with it? And how does it differ from, and we've talked about alopecia and went into some detail about that. Is there a connection between vitiligo and alopecia? So lots of questions. Why don't we start with telling us what vitiligo is?
Right. So vitiligo is essentially the loss of melanocytes. And melanocytes are these cells that are in our skin that give pigmentation. Okay, so you were asking how common it is. It's extremely common. It affects 0.5 to 2% of the world's population. And it can start at any age, childhood and adulthood, but usually it starts in the second or third decade of life. And so that would be about when you notice it in your friend.
Can I just ask, as you talk about pigmentation, does this affect people who have white skin, but you just can't see it on their skin?
Exactly. So it's often more obvious in people with darker skin.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Exactly. And so you get these, what we call amelanotic, so no pigment, non-scaly white or chalky white macule. So macule is a flat area on your skin. And so you'll get these. And one thing to keep in mind is that vitiligo, even though it's a skin condition, it's not life-threatening. It can have a significant impact on daily life. And we can talk about this later. And so it should never be dismissed as an aesthetic or minor illness. And as well, it should not be dismissed as something that cannot be treated.
Okay.
But getting back to your question, you were asking about the cause.
Yes.
So we don't quite know,
Okay.
We know that it is definitely an autoimmune disorder associated with defects in either metabolism or what's called oxidative stress on your cells, maybe provoking this autoimmune attack. And we know this, of course, because we'll talk about some of the treatments are autoimmune medications. We do know that there's both genetic and environmental factors. It depends. Some people say it's about 80% genetic and 20% environmental, though these are always just estimates. So we know that if you have vitiligo, there is a 20% chance there'll be a first degree relative that's also affected. Oh. And if you are a twin, a monozygotic twin, so identical twins, the concordance rate is about 23%. So it's not purely genetic, obviously, because then the identical twins would both have it. But we also know that it's commonly associated with a lot of other autoimmune diseases, right? And this is what you were getting at, I think, before with the. So it is associated with alopecia areata, okay? But it's most associated with thyroid disease. One study looked at over 2,000 patients with vitiligo, and almost 20% had an autoimmune thyroid disease, which is 8 times higher than the general population. So definitely thyroid disease is a huge link. And so we always check for thyroid disease, but other things like rheumatoid arthritis, diabetes, lupus, psoriasis, and even just eczema or what's called atopic dermatitis can be associated.
So would you say that often when somebody has vitiligo, they will have one of these associated conditions? Yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, very, very commonly. And so it's very important for doctors to screen people for these disorders.
Okay. So that also speaks to this idea that vitiligo shouldn't be dismissed as something simple because it also,
right, exactly,
the psychological aspects, which we will talk about, and then the other associated conditions. Okay, so is it the diagnosis is simple enough that when you see it on somebody's skin, then you know that somebody has vitiligo, or does it start in a
relatively, yeah, relatively. So, you know, you obviously, if you're concerned about this, you see your doctor. You'll find these patches, which are often on the fingertips, knuckles, around the lips, around the eyes, around the toes, or reproductive organs is where you'd see them the most initially. And of course, when you see them, you want to ask about thyroid symptoms, history of autoimmune disorders, either in the person or in their family, vitiligo in the family, etc. And so you'll find these patches, these macules on them. And they can also occur in areas that are subjected to trauma. So like your knees and elbows, where, you know, if you fall or scrape them, that's often like it'll be your knees or elbows. So that's called Koebnerization. Koebnerization is the appearance of new skin lesions on previously unaffected areas because of a trauma. And so you'd get the vitiligo in these areas, and that can occur into 20 to 60% of vitiligo patients. So your doctor may examine your knees or elbows to see, you know, these areas that you commonly have some trauma to them, to see if those are areas that are affected.
Okay. And I'm not getting the sense of the feeling in the skin. Is there ever any pain? Is that an...
No, good point. No, definitely not. Good question.
Okay. You know, we should mention somebody named Chantal Whitney Brown-Young, who's known as Winnie Harlow professionally, since 2014 has been talking about vitiligo, has been kind of a public spokesperson, right? She's a model. She was on, first discovered on America's Next Top Model, and then on the Beyonce visual album. She was on that. She's been on a, you know, show called Making the Cut on Amazon Prime. So she talks a lot about this condition, which she very clearly has. And if anybody wants to know more about it from somebody who has it, we should mention that as well, right? Like, do you have young kids who come in with vitiligo to your practice?
Not to me, because there's not a lot of neurologic overlap. So I think the endocrinologist would see them. And of course, I work with pediatric dermatologists who would see these patients. But I'm not sure how commonly they see them, to be honest with you.
You mentioned where it starts on the body, and you said to start. So are there different types that, you know, have... that take on, you know, more sort of spreading across the body, and some that are more limited?
Yep. There's different types. So there's a localized one that's, you know, your doctor may diagnose that if you only have a few patches over a small area, that could be like your friend that you were talking about. Then there's non-segmental vitiligo. So that's getting patches on both sides of the body. There's some symmetry between the two sides, and it often appears more in sun-exposed areas, so the face, neck, hands, and this is the most common type. Then there's something called segmental vitiligo, where you only get color loss on one side of the body for some reason. You know, maybe the researchers know why, but it can be very progressive. Then after 6 to 12 months, it can be more constant and stable and stop. And then you don't often develop new patches after that. This is less common, only about 5 to 16% of people with vitiligo. And it also occurs more at a younger age. And so, and it's important to know, because some of the treatments don't work as well for segmental vitiligo. So again, it's important to see your doctor and then to see a dermatologist to help figure out which type someone has, because it may affect the treatment.
So you mentioned treatment twice just now, which we'll get to, but can we talk about the psychological impact of having vitiligo?
Yeah. So you can imagine, like, as I was getting at that before, you know, it's not a deadly disease, but the psychological impact on it can be very high. And so there have been studies where they look at quality of life, and they experience a very high burden of disease affecting their quality of life compared to healthy people. And it's worse with people with darker skin or from South Asian cultures. That's been well described. And I think Ali and I can appreciate that. Just knowing friends or relatives who have vitiligo, it likely is tough, because it's more obvious when you have darker skin. Winnie Harlow, of course, has dark skin, right? And so it is more obvious.
Yeah, which is part of why I bring her up, that, you know, despite all the challenges that you would have as somebody with vitiligo on your face, she is a model, and she is, you know, sort of, you know, out there, I think probably serves as a source of inspiration for many people. Yeah.
And so when you look at quality of life impairment in some of these vitiligo patients, it can be worse or comparable to other diseases like chronic lung disease, arthritis, or even cancer. So you can't dismiss the effect that this could have on somebody just because, again, it's not the same as you're not going to die like you would die from cancer. So depression, they think about 33% of vitiligo patients will have it, and anxiety, maybe about 35, 36% seeing anxiety in these patients. And then you could also have a lot of other psychological issues, so feelings of stigmatization, sleep problems, avoidance or restrictive behavior. You can imagine I don't want to go out because of this. Relationship difficulties, sexual dysfunction. Again, we talked about how a lot of the areas around the sexual organs can be affected, so that might affect your sexual health as well.
Yeah, Winnie Harlow does talk publicly about feelings of suicide that she had because of the bullying that accompanied her throughout her life, especially in school and high school. Yeah. Okay, so what can be done, if anything, about, because you said it is a bit of a fallacy that there's no treatment. There is some treatment.
Right,
and
I
do know that my friend who was getting, you know, for his chin, he was getting some kind of treatment and it doesn't.
Yeah. So I would suggest people go see their doctor early if they see patches like this to get it diagnosed. Obviously, you want to use sunscreen on the lighter skin, again, especially in darker individuals who may not. I don't use a ton of sunscreen. Ali does more because he's lighter skinned than me. But, you know, darker skinned people may not be used to using sunscreen, but you definitely have to use it on these areas because you don't want to get damage, sunburns, and then, of course, you know, the risk of developing a malignancy from there. The extremities, face, throat, body, they're most responsive to treatment. The areas around the mouth and your distal limbs, so your fingers or your toes, are actually the most resistant to treatment. Doesn't mean you wouldn't try. If you have this non-segmental vitiligo that's less than 10% of your body surface, you would start off with corticosteroids. So we talked about corticosteroids many times in the podcast. These are strong anti-inflammatory medications, and you'd use those topically, so on the affected areas, like as a cream or an ointment. You could also use what are called some calcium modulators. So there are these vitamin D analogs, which we think that a problem with calcium transport can affect these melanocytes. So given a vitamin D analog, you can try. And there's also things called calcineurin inhibitors. So tacrolimus is one, pimecrolimus is another one. And these are used in dermatology a lot for various disorders, but you can use these are called calcineurin inhibitors. And so you can use those on the face as well. So that's the kind of first line therapy, these topical treatments. And they do have certain side effects, but most people are willing to put up with the side effects because they want, you know, improvement cosmetically. Then if you go to second line therapy, you actually use phototherapy with ultraviolet radiation. So you do this narrowband ultraviolet phototherapy, sometimes combined with other things. And it's a known treatment, vitiligo. It actually acts as an immunosuppressive, and it promotes the proliferation of these melanocytes, these pigmented cells. So light therapy is another possibility. And then afterwards, you could go to taking steroids by mouth. So they would affect your whole body. But again, if you have lots of areas involved, that might be better than just putting a steroid cream on various parts of your body. Now, there's a couple other things that we should probably talk about. There's skin grafts, where you take a healthy piece of pigmented skin and use them to cover the affected areas, but that's not very common because it can also cause scarring when you do the skin graft. So it's not very common to do that. Some people will do a micropigment tattoo over some areas. That may work if you have light to medium skin tones. Doesn't really work with dark skin tones. And obviously, like, you'd have to do a lot. Sometimes the tattooing, the skin damage from the tattooing, can trigger another patch of vitiligo. Remember, we talked about that fact that areas of trauma can sometimes develop vitiligo. So sometimes it doesn't really work. But interesting, and now we're kind of going full circle back to Michael Jackson, you could do depigmentation. When the affected area affects half the body or more, you can reduce the skin color in the unaffected parts so it matches the whiter areas better. And so you can use topical lotions or ointments. There's one called monobenzyl ether of hydroquinone. Never heard of this before. 4-methoxyphenol, and then just phenol. So it can make your skin more fragile, and it can take years to try and get this to match up, in quotation marks. But of course, this would explain perhaps people thought that Michael Jackson was bleaching his skin to look more white, but, you know, his argument was he had vitiligo. Then I always thought to myself, well, why don't you have patches on your skin like Winnie Harlow would, right? But this may be the reason why he may have indulged in this, but this is all speculation.
It's speculation because Michael Jackson never came out and said he has vitiligo and this is what he's doing for it. He just said he has vitiligo, period. Is that right?
Exactly.
What happens to people over time with regards to this this condition?
Well, it's a bit unpredictable. So some patients can get spontaneous repigmentation over the depigmented areas, but it depends a bit on the age of onset and how extensive it is. Early onset of disease is usually associated with more of the body being covered and a higher rate of progression. So it's better to have it onset earlier. And interestingly, obviously it can be responsive to treatment, like I said, especially if you have very localized disease. So you want to see somebody quickly if you are suspecting that you may have this. But people do have these intermittent cycles, not just of repigmentation, but then pigment loss again, and then stabilization. It goes up and down. The reasons for this are unclear, and we didn't talk about this. There's many, many new therapies coming out, and we only scratched the surface in terms of therapy. So how will these therapies affect this, the cycle of pigmentation, depigmentation, repigmentation, etc. I'm not sure over time, but it's certainly an area of study currently in dermatology. So that's our episode for today. Let us know what you guys thought. Very important to hear from you guys to let us know what you thought. We talked about a pretty, I would say, controversial subject with art versus artist, and a very personal thing. Everybody has their own takes on it, and I think that's okay. That's by definition, it's a personal opinion-based subject, so we'd be curious to hear what you guys think about this. DrVComedian@gmail.com, DrVComedian on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. We are everywhere. Anything you got coming up in the next couple of months?
Oh, a couple of things here and there, a little bit of travel. I'll be, you know what? StandupAli.com is the website. That's where people can see my upcoming, live touring that's happening.
Sounds good, Ali. But remember that although I'm a doctor, I'm not your doctor. Medical issues we talk about are for your interest and information only, and they're not medical advice. Please consult your medical professionals for actual medical advice. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.